And every country has a legal obligation to regulate these private companies that are operating within their borders. And a failure to do so is a breach of international law.
And you say the true reach of fossil fuel tentacles is undoubtedly deeper, as the lobbyist data excludes executives and other company representatives, unofficial country delegations. You particularly single out United Arab Emirates, Russia, and Azerbaijan. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, a whole bunch of countries will include in their official delegations executives from some of the biggest corporations. So they are there in these secret country-to-country, state-to-state level negotiations, making climate policy. You know, we have this is the 30th year of climate of these climate talks, and you know we have countries have absolutely failed to take the climate action necessary that science tells us that we need to take, and that indigenous people and frontline communities have been telling us that we need to take for decades now, right? We need to stop fossil fuel extraction. We need to phase out fossil fuels. We need to cut subsidies. We need to cut consumption. And these executives having a seat at the table when actually climate vulnerable countries cannot actually attend in big numbers because of the huge costs and other barriers involved is completely outrageous. And they do it because it enables them to keep drilling. It enables them to block climate action that we need to take in order to come off fossil fuels.
And two of those countries, in the case of UAE and Azerbaijan, they hosted the COP summits.
Yeah, absolutely. In Azerbaijan last year, there was more than 1,700 fossil fuel lobbyists present. That was more, like many more than 10 of the most climate vulnerable countries in the world had in their delegations, right? I mean, every year it's getting worse rather than better. And honestly, the response from the UN is absolutely, like, it's bonkers, you know? I mean, they said to me, we can't change, we can't solve this problem overnight, just like we can't solve the climate crisis overnight. Well, actually, they could. They could just ban fossil fuel lobbyists and all other lobbyists from polluting industries attending the UN climate summits. That's not a hard thing to do. You know, we have more information about who's going. There's more, you know, but that's not enough. Like, they just need to get these polluters out of the negotiations so that climate action can actually be taken.
You've also written a really important piece, Existential and Urgent: What Impact Will ICJ, the International Court of Justice, Climate Ruling, Have on COP30? This also goes to the issue of loss and damage, which will bring us back to Yeb Sanyo, because the Philippines is the host of the who's in charge of loss and damage. Explain it all.
Yeah, so the Loss and Damage Fund, which is a fund that some of the island nations and other vulnerable countries have been campaigning for decades now, but the wealthy polluting countries have blocked, was finally 2 years ago created. And this is a fund that is being managed out of the Philippines, which is an extremely climate vulnerable country, as we've heard already. And the agreement was that, you know, the wealthy polluting nations would contribute to this fund to help pay for the irreversible loss and damage that countries are already experiencing. 2 years on, only $750 million has been actually agreed or has been pledged to that fund. We need hundreds of billions of dollars every single year. I mean, look at Melissa, you know, in the Caribbean. I mean, huge swathes of mountains in Jamaica have had all of the trees swept, you know, like just knocked down by the heavy winds. I mean, it's billions of dollars of damage just in Jamaica.
We had a British Jamaican activist on after Hurricane Melissa hit Jamaica. And she said they shouldn't be named after women and men like Hurricane Melissa, which sounds so innocent. These hurricanes should be named for oil companies.
Yeah, Hurricane Exxon, Hurricane Chevron, Hurricane Petrobras. Absolutely. You know, it's, I mean, these are, you know, these storms, and, you know, we've seen the one in Philippines over the weekend, Melissa, but so many more, they are absolutely being turbocharged by the increasing temperatures in the atmosphere and the ocean. There is no doubt about that, right? And coming back to the ICJ ruling, so the ICJ in July issued a landmark advisory opinion, which made it abundantly clear that every single state in the world is legally bound to take climate action, to issue with due diligence, to do everything in their powers to mitigate, to remedy, and to prevent the climate crisis, which they said presents an urgent and existential threat to the planet and therefore humanity. This is a universal obligation. So the US leaving the Paris Agreement, I'm sorry, it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make the US not bound under international law, to take meaningful climate action. And it went really far. It was the furthest any sort of court has ever gone on fossil fuels. It said that every single, the states have a legal obligation under international law to stop fossil fuel extraction, consumption, licenses and subsidies. And that duty, that legal duty, extends to the regulation of corporations that are operating within their borders. A failure to do so amounts to an international wrongful act that could be subject to legal consequences. And so why does this matter, right? So every time you hear of a fossil fuel expansion plan, we had one just recently in Brazil by Petrobras, which is a majority state-owned oil company. They're going to start exploring off the in the ocean
in Brazil,
right? That is a violation of international of international law, right? The law is very clear that fossil fuel expansion has to stop, right? And so and it's up to Brazil as a state to regulate the companies operating in their boundaries. Now, what Petrobras said to me is that Petrobras have sent dozens of lobbyists, by the way, to COP in the last few years. We want to be there. We want to be following energy policy. We want to be part of the solution. And how is this a solution? You know, starting drilling close to the mouth of the Amazon, which is home to 10% of the world's biodiversity.
As we begin to wrap up, Yeb Sanyo in Belen, where the UN COP is happening, COP 30. Global emissions have nearly doubled in the last 33 years. Your country, the Philippines, is the home of the Loss and Damage Fund, which has hardly been funded. You're the former chief climate negotiator for the Philippines. Now you're a leading climate activist. What gives you hope, and what does it mean to say that this summit is an action summit?
Well, I like that you refer to the word hope. I take that as something that I wake up every morning with, which is not a choice, but to carry hope, because and that's what I wish I could bring into the conversation here, including many faith communities that have come here to Belém. COPs, and now we're in the 30th edition of this. I see a lot of young people here, and world leaders have been negotiating on climate change longer than these young people have been alive. That's very striking. That's very telling in how this process has been for three decades. I have no illusion, Amy. I have no illusion that the 30th edition of the COP could deliver something groundbreaking and something that would change the landscape of climate action just because we are in Brazil, just because we are in Belém, the gateway of the Amazon. But this is a place where, I can say, you earlier asked what has changed over the course of the past decade. I can say that the movement has evolved and has become much stronger. And this is where the international climate movement converges every year. And this is where we could show the power of people, show the power of communities, of indigenous communities, of young people, of women, of faith communities who are doing a lot on the ground, at the grassroots in many parts of the world. So I have firm belief that hope is possible, and that we can drive ambition and push political leaders by mobilizing the necessary political pressure that can overcome, as we have just been hearing, the fossil fuel lobby, the influence, the conflict of interest, and the vested interests that are almost always at play in these negotiations.
Yevsanyo, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Former chief climate negotiator for the Philippines, now chair of the Laudato Si movement, formerly known as the Global Catholic Climate Movement. Also executive director of CECOT, a grassroots environmental community development organization in the Philippines. Finally, we just have 30 seconds, Nina Lacani. Your latest piece talks about the hundreds of millions of refugees, climate refugees around the world as Europe and the United States shuts down their borders. The countries most responsible for climate change, stopping refugees from fleeing the effects of climate change, the intense typhoons and hurricanes and more.
Yeah, the UN Refugee Agency's new report shows that there's been an average of 70,000 displacements every single day due to climate disasters over the last 10 years. And many of the countries that are hosting climate displaced people are also countries who are facing conflict, right? So just to bring this back to the COP30, you know, 25 UN special rapporteurs are releasing a statement this morning that will basically say that a failure to take really strong action towards the end of fossil fuels and banning fossil fuel lobbyists will absolutely be the end of the credibility of this process that has really failed for the last 30 years to do what it needs to do to prevent climate disasters that are causing, you know, huge amounts of displacement around the world now.
Nina Lacani, senior climate justice reporter for The Guardian U.S., will link to your recent articles at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Will be reporting from the UN Climate Summit in Belém, Brazil, throughout next week. Coming up, Jelani Cobb, dean of the Columbia Journalism School. He has a new book out. It's called Three or More is a Riot, Notes on How We Got Here. Stay with us.
And any man who knows a thing knows he knows not a damn thing at all. And every time I felt the hurt and I felt the giving getting me up off the wall, I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it breeze. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute. How did Mandela get the will to surpass the everyday when injustice had him caged and trapped in every way? How did Gandhi ever withstand the hunger strikes and all? Didn't do it to gain power or money, if I recall, it's the gift. I guess I'll pass it on. Mother thinks it'll lift the stress of Babylon. Mother knows. My mother, she suffered blows. I don't know how we survived such violent episodes. I was so worried. It hurt to see you bleed. But as soon as you came out the hospital, you gave me sweets, yeah. They tried to take you from me. But you still only gave them some prayers and sympathy, dear mama. You helped me write this by showing me to give is priceless. And any man who knows a thing knows he knows not a damn thing at all. And every time I felt the hurt and I felt the giving getting me up off the wall, I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it breathe. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute.
Take a Minute by Kanon in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Three or More is a Riot, Notes on How We Got Here. That's the name of a new collection of essays by Jelani Cobb, the acclaimed journalist, dean of the Columbia Journalism School. The book collects essays beginning in 2012 with the killing of Trayvon Martin in Florida. It traces the rise of Donald Trump and the right's growing embrace of white nationalism, as well as the historic racial justice protests after the police killing of George Floyd in 2020. Ta-Nehisi Coates writes, quote, "We live in a time when writers like Cobb are being targeted by the highest powers in this nation. Read this book to understand why." Jelani Cobb, thanks so much for being with us. Congratulations on the release of your book. Why don't we just start off with the title, Three or More is a Riot, mm-hmm. Notes on How We Got Here. Mm-hmm. How did we get here and where are we?
So, you know, there's an interesting kind of dynamic here. And I wrote about this recently in that you know, in the summer of 1965, well, summer, fall 1965, Lyndon B. Johnson signed two pieces of legislation that are really at the center of the kind of volatile politics that we're dealing with now. In August, he signed, early August of 1965, he signed, you know, famously the Voting Rights Act. And then in early October of that same year, he signed the immigration, Hart-Celler's Immigration Reform Act. The Immigration Reform Act transformed the face of American immigration. It opened the doors for immigration from places like Africa, from India, from the Caribbean, from Latin America, places that had been widely prohibited from people from immigrating from in earlier versions of American immigration law. And the Voting Rights Act changed the face of the American electorate. What we're seeing, and, you know, what I didn't understand when I first started writing these essays, and you know, I couldn't because some of this history hadn't played out yet, what we're seeing is a kind of retrograde push or reactionary push to try to return the nation to the status quo ante, to undo the kind of demographic change, literally at gunpoint, as we see. And, you know, at the same time as we are pushing people of color out of the country, you know, by force, we are making space for specifically white South Africans, not just South Africans, but specifically white South Africans. And we see these cases being brought to try to diminish, if not completely eviscerate, the Voting Rights Act. And so it's trying to return to a kind of the old demography or the demography of old. And, you know, as I started writing for The New Yorker in 2012, the first thing I wrote about was Trayvon Martin, who becomes, you know, this kind of almost inciting incident. Black Lives Matter emerges out of that. And to a strange degree, a great deal of radicalization on the right comes out of that as well. Because just a few years later, we see the horrific murder of nine African Americans in the church, in Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina, Charleston, South Carolina. The person who was responsible for those homicides, Dylan Roof, said that he did it as a call to arms for white people, that he wanted white people to reassert their place and their primary position in American society, and that he had been radicalized by, of all things, the Trayvon Martin incident. And so these things have kind of unfolded in a kind of tree diagram almost since then.
I remember we interviewed you first in Ferguson after the killing of Mike Brown.
Yeah.
Maybe we have that clip, but you have an essay in the book, What I Saw in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. You open it by quoting Richard Wright's poem, Between the World and Me, about a lynching and how history is an animate force. You write, the dry bones stirred, rattled, lifted, melting themselves into my bones, and the gray ashes formed flesh firm and black, entering into my flesh. And then you write, I spent 8 days in Ferguson, and in that time I developed a kind of between the world and Ferguson view of events surrounding Brown's death. Mm-hmm. I was once a linebacker-sized 18-year-old, too, when I saw then what black people have been required to know is that there are few things more dangerous than the perception that one is a danger.
Yeah.
Take it from there.
Yeah. So when we saw, even in Ferguson, which was like another stair step, you know, in this kind of ratcheting intensification of these dynamics. And this is happening in the Obama era. And the Obama DOJ people are seeking, you know, some sort of assistance from the Obama DOJ in these instances. Or will this be different? Will the fact that there's a black president mean that this will be handled differently? And at the same time, there is this kind of growing white allergic reaction to these social demonstrations. Now, Michael Brown was killed. His body lay in the street for almost 4 hours in an August day, a kind of blazing hot August afternoon. And there is a entire community traumatized by there being a dead body, a person whom they know, who's laying in the street for hour after hour after hour. And out of that, there was another kind of step that we saw, and that was where kind of Black Lives Matter came into full fruition, and you began to see that movement grow and develop. On the other side of it, you know, we're kind of moving toward the reaction that enables Trumpism, that enables, you know, when he comes down the escalator in Trump Tower in 2015, June of 2015, coincidentally, he does this, comes down the escalator and announces his candidacy the day before the incident in which the nine people are killed in Charleston. So things happen 24 hours apart. Not that there's a causal relationship between these or anything like that, but it's just this common response to the zeitgeist of and the belief that somehow white people have been pushed out of their ordained position in American society.
There's a great deal of solidarity between African American human rights movement and the Palestinian human rights mm-hmm. movement, and also the Jewish human mm-hmm. rights mm-hmm. movement. You are the dean of the prestigious School of Journalism at Columbia mm-hmm. University. You were there during the encampments and Columbia calling in the police mm-hmm. several times. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can talk about both situations. One, the journalists and mm-hmm. a number of them from your own school. I mean, journalists were seeing your school as a shelter. Mm-hmm. You even had a showdown with police telling mm-hmm. them mm-hmm. to stop arresting journalists. Mm-hmm. If you can talk about the students at WKCR, right. Columbia Spectator, your own students, the graduate students in your school, being attacked by police or arrested by police and the response of your university, Columbia.
I mean, I'll just tell you, I have been doing this for a long time. It's hard for me to believe, but I have been teaching for almost 30 years. I have never been more proud of a group of students than I was of those students who went out and reported. There were students who, and I didn't encourage them to do this. As a matter of fact, I encouraged them to do the opposite. But there were students who were out doing 24-hour shifts, reporting on what was happening, you know, filming, documenting. One student, which was, it was amazing because it was the exact right answer. But someone from the New York Times called me on my cell phone, and I was in the middle of doing a bunch of things, and I'm kind of running around. And they said, can someone give me, like, just some color about what's going on the campus? And I hand the phone to a student, and I was like, this is someone from the Times. They just want to know what's going on. And the student said, yeah, I have my own story to work on. And I thought that was great. That was the perfect response. But they were really out there pursuing those stories. And, you know, in instances, you know, I did have to come out and, you know, intervene because there were police officers, NYPD, once they got to the campus, and they were not making, you know, any distinctions. They were just kind of arresting people. And I was like, these are students, these are journalists, these are, you know, kind of people. You know, at one point someone, you know, threatened to arrest me, and it was just kind of like, you know, it's my job as dean to work on behalf of my students. And so on the Columbia side, you know, a lot of that is kind of privileged. But what I'll say is that, you know, our interactions with everyone from the outside community to inside to, you know, the leadership, our kind of marching orders were to defend the freedom of the press and defend the First Amendment and academic freedom and our students' ability to report. That was the students from KCR who weren't even students at the Graduate School of Journalism, but students from The Spectator, which is the student paper, and the students who were enrolled at Columbia Journalism School. And that was what we articulated to the best of our ability.
And overall, as you talk about notes on how we got here, President Trump's attack on universities from
Absolutely.
Columbia to schools all over the country.
So here's a thing.
And the connection between DEI and what he calls anti-Semitism.
Sure. So on the first thing, one of the things that, you know, few people have noticed, or maybe people have noticed, but it hasn't gotten a ton of attention, is that in all of these incursions into the autonomy of these institutions, one of the main things that the administration has demanded is that they there's some language about reducing the number of international students on their campuses. And this has been done because very often acceptance into an American university, acceptance into an American graduate school is the first step in someone ultimately becoming a citizen. They may graduate, they'll get, sponsored for a work visa, and then, a green card, and then, become a citizen, or perhaps they marry someone. That's the first step. And they are attempting to foreclose that route. They're attempting to reduce the number of people who are becoming naturalized citizens. And they're using the pressures that they're exerting on American universities in order to do so. And it was convenient, I think, to use these kinds of canards about DEI as a wedge issue. To kind of like, well, are you opposed to anti-Semitism or are you in favor of DEI? As if a person couldn't hold both of those views. And there was no natural reason that you couldn't hold both of those views. But for a moment, this is kind of the rhetoric that we were receiving, the kind of propaganda we were receiving. And you would actually believe that these things are opposed or oppositional.
And if you can comment on just Friday, the Trump administration reaching a multi-million-dollar deal with Cornell University to restore more than $250 million in federal funding for the school. The education secretary saying the Trump administration secured another transformative commitment from an Ivy League institution to end divisive DEI policies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is ultimately an attempt. So it begins with the kind of belief that no one who holds a position, unless apparently they are white men, is actually qualified or entitled to be in that position. And that DEI, which has been an effort to look beyond the normal parameters of what have been natural, what have become routine parameters, to hire the same people who had been in the same positions from the start of time, virtually, and to say we want our institutions to be inclusive of everyone who can possibly contribute to the institution. That's not a radical idea, but it has been reframed in such a way as a kind of zero-sum game in which white men are being denied the positions that they should rightfully hold. And, that's what's at stake here.
And you have Columbia, your institutional, pay a $200 million settlement over 3 years to the federal government, also agreeing to settle Columbia investigations brought by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Do you see this as a huge concession? Are you critical of this?
A lot of that is kind of like privileged because I'm a dean. What I'll say is that I wasn't happy with the situation at all. And what I tended to do was that I could exert my energy being kind of internally critical, or I can exert my energy about the fact that we should never have had to make those decisions in the first place. My criticism has been that, this is an unprecedented incursion into the autonomy of an institution of higher education, and it sets a terrible precedent. And so academic freedom, has been infringed upon. The ability of even kind of to the point of making demands about particular, departments and programs at a university. And this is, unheard of. This is not something that we've seen before outside of the McCarthy period, which is the closest thing that we've seen when, the great historian Ellen Schrecker has done her work on McCarthyism in higher education. And all of a sudden, we're looking at, these books about the 1950s in American universities and seeing templates for what's happening in the 2020s in American universities.
Well, Jelani Kav, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dean of the Columbia Journalism School, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. His new book, Three or More is a Riot, Notes on How We Got Here, 2012 to 2025. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.
Appreciate your generosity. Each year, for a week, we host Fund Drive, our annual fundraising campaign that augments our budget and supports our operations. It is thanks to you that we can rise higher and reach further.